Today on Off Mic, the U.S. Supreme Court pushes back on the Trump administration and its move to dissolve the DACA program. This gives nearly a million people brought to the United States as children hope. We talked to a college student in Northwest Indiana who was directly impacted by this decision. We also talked to a local attorney who works on DACA issues. We also talked to three local people about ongoing discussions about police reform. All this on Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente, Northwest Indiana Bureau reporter for WBEZ. The Supreme Court ruled Thursday that the Trump administration cannot carry out its plan to shut down the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA for short. That is a program that nearly 800,000 young people known as Dreamers to avoid deportation and remain in the United States. Chief Justice John Roberts was a swing vote in the 5-4 decision, which deals a big legal defeat to President Trump on the issue of immigration, a major focus of his domestic agenda. And joining us to talk about this decision, it directly impacts a DACA, a Dreamer, is Northwest Indiana resident Martha Gallegos. Martha, welcome to Off Mic.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
Good. Thank you for joining us here. Well, let me ask you this. Before we get into the weeds of your little bit of your background and everything, what was your initial reaction when you heard about yesterday's ruling?
Honestly, my first reaction was, you know, kind of feeling a sense of relief, you know, that they finally decided that DACA will stay, you know, but, you know, the fight continues. It's not over yet. I feel like what was decided yesterday was basically like a Band-Aid that, you know, just to kind of like, in a sense, calm us down. But I feel like there's so much more work that has to be done.
But do you feel like it's not over with? I realize that. Everyone realizes that. But do you think at least this thing is probably not going to be able to be dealt with way into if President Trump has his second term or a new president comes in?
In my opinion, I think until either the new president or probably the next term, I feel like they tend to really take their time with these issues specifically. So, I mean, only time will tell, but, you know, in all hope, we hope that, you know, they were to resolve these issues as soon as possible.
Okay, Martha, now let's get a little bit back. Tell us a little bit about your background. When did your parents come from to the United States? How long have you been here?
Sure. So I was brought here when I was about 8 months old. And at first, me and my parents, you know, we lived in Texas and we lived in Kansas for a few months to then finally moving here to Indiana. I've grown up here in Indiana basically my entire life. I've gone to school here. And so this is basically my home. I'm 21 years old now, and I go to Purdue University Northwest. I'm studying political science with a minor in public policy administration. And yeah.
That's it. And let me ask you this. When you were growing up, when did you realize that perhaps this Dreamer, the talk about Dreamers and deferred action, DACA, that it might apply to you?
Honestly, I think from a very young age, I always knew. My parents always made it aware. I think probably once I got to middle school and once I started to, you know, comprehend a little more on these issues, you know, I was told and I knew that, you know, I was undocumented. But it wasn't until later on, probably until like high school, until I was actually closer to graduating high school, that I realized that, you know, this was going to be very difficult for me. This was going to be very different. It wasn't going to be easy. And I knew that I was going to struggle. you know, but in 2012, when DACA came out, I mean, that completely changed, you know, everything for a lot of us. And it is a great help, you know, the fact that we're able to have this work permit and, you know, we're able to go to school, we're able to work and have driver's license, honestly really benefits us, especially, you know, being protected from deportation. It honestly does did a great help and still continue to do so.
And where did you go to high school?
I went to high school at Morton here in Hammond. Morton High School.
Growing up, and it might, you know, growing up, was it difficult knowing, did you face any kind of backlash because of your status as being undocumented?
I would say not specifically, nothing really major like that. I say growing up, I know that it was very difficult for my parents, and it still is to this day it is. And, you know, gratefully and thank God, we never had to face any big difficulties like that where, you know, I've had relatives and I know of people that have had their parents pulled over, you know, and they get arrested. And it's a very scary situation, you know, because our parents, they have sacrificed so much for us. They wake up every day and they go to work, and in their back of the mind, in their minds, you know, something that is very normal for everyone else is that the fear of possibly getting pulled over and, you know, not being able to present the correct documents, not being able to show a driver's license is honestly something, you know, very fearful to be about. And I know so many instances, you know, with my parents, that's something that my dad was always something very afraid of, and I'm sure a lot of people, you know, face those same situations.
Martha, was the situation made worse or maybe better because you grew up in an area that is a little bit more diverse, more Latinos here? Did that help in any way, or did it hamper the situation?
I think both. Maybe, but I think more on the side, towards the side of that, you know, Northwest Indiana being so close to Chicagoland area, we're very diverse. And, you know, some of the things that we've been seeing lately, you know, is showing us, it's making us, you know, open our eyes and realize that racism still exists. And, you know, there's, especially with the Trump administration, it's, you know, it has made things so much more worse. But I think that Northwest Indiana is very diverse. And so, but when you think of it and you go, I don't know, a little more down South Indiana, or there's been instances even that my dad, he works in landscaping and he has his own little business with that. He's faced many people that have, you know, kind of showed racism towards him and has said, you know, very hurtful things that, you know, you would think that you wouldn't see that here in Northwest Indiana, but it in some ways, you still do see it.
Can you explain, you know, a lot of people, when they hear it, when they talk about things about immigration and undocumented, they'll say, well, my parents did it the right way. Why can't your parents do the right way? But let me ask you this. What have you heard about the background? Have you heard about why your parents felt the need to try to make it to the United States?
Sure. I mean, just like anyone else, you know, everyone comes here. My parents came here for the American dream, essentially. And, you know, they come here for a better life that they want to give us, their children. And, you know, I'm glad that my parents decided it that way. I couldn't imagine my life any other way, you know, despite the sacrifices and despite the difficulties that has never stopped me or my family. But I think it is, you know, kind of amazing to see that no matter what, people still fight and people still, you know, try the hardest to, you know, to make it, essentially.
Let me ask you this. When you see some of the images, especially, you know, last year of children locked in cages, children who were brought here, such as you. But in their situation, their parents rounded up children locked in cages on near the Mexican border. That could have been you.
Oh, yeah. Honestly, there's like a little story of, you know, how exactly of how when me and my parents came there, there's a little story of how essentially I was, you know, basically crossed over. And it's basically kind of similar for anyone else. But being 8 months old, of course, you know, a baby at that age will have no remembrance. But it's crazy to think that at any given moment, you hear all these stories of when people are crossing over and people have that need and they're so desperate because they want a better life and, you know, they want to come here to work. And you hear so many stories that of people dying, people being kidnapped. And then, you know, these things happen. Or essentially, you know, when people face issues with the police and get arrested and things like that, then the process continues of where, you know, possibly a deportation proceeding begins. And then if there's obviously kids involved that are also undocumented, that's, you know, that's how it all starts. But it's honestly crazy to me that people are still allowing it. There's even in these past couple of days, you continue to see how these babies, these kids are still being locked up, and then many are being raped. And many women are also being raped. So I think that there's something that we need to do and there's something that needs to be changed because it's just simply not right.
Well, Martha Gallegos is a local student attending Purdue University Northwest. She's a political science major, a senior, and a DACA student. Martha Gallegos, thank you so much for joining us here on Off Mic.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you, Mike.
And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
Indiana Democrats now have a candidate for Attorney General. Question is, which Republican will he face in November? I'm Matt Pelzer. Next time on All In, we'll catch up on the week's biggest headlines, like the governor's promise that despite the budget shortfall, there will be no cuts to K-12 education. And a new novel set in Indiana addresses a lot of the current issues being grappled with around race and sexuality. We'll talk to the book's author, a Central Indiana native. Join us. Join us every day at noon here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
From celebrity interviews to upcoming local entertainment events, Midwest Beat has you covered. Music, art, comedy, magic, Tom Lounges has covered it all. Join Tom Lounges on Midwest Beat as he continues to get you the latest stories on all your favorite artists and your favorite you haven't heard yet. Listen to Midwest Beat every Friday at 1 and again at 7 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. During these trying times, we've been restricting the amount of guests we have in the Lakeshore studios. However, recently we've been lucky enough with the proper precautions to have Chef Nick back in the studio. Chef Nick got a chance to talk on the phone to touch base with a few fooderies and alcohol establishments and how they are dealing with COVID. This Friday at 3 o'clock, check out a special edition of Let's Eat with Chef Nick, right here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente, Northwest Indiana Bureau reporter for WBEZ. We've been talking about the decision yesterday from the U.S. Supreme Court disallowing a challenge by the Trump administration that would have essentially dissolved the program and 700,000 to 800,000 people under the DACA program, children who were brought here by their parents who were undocumented, was pretty much in limbo or possibly facing deportation. And local attorney Alfredo Estrada is joining us now. He works on DACA cases. Mr. Estrada, thank you for joining us here on Off Mic.
Thanks, Michael. How are you doing?
Good. What was the day like for you yesterday?
Well, we woke up expecting something. So I was watching, you know, the web to see if something would come out on the website. And once we got that, you know, it was a big relief for immigration attorneys. But then once reading the opinion, you know, you got to see the reality of the opinion and the reality of the situation for a DACA DACA recipient.
And tell me, how do you work on a lot of cases of DACA? How many approximately clients do you have that fall under this category?
Well, you know, it kind of, I would say 95% of my immigration practice, 90% of my immigration practice deals with undocumented. As for DACA, I couldn't specifically tell you, but the caseload for DACA reduced under the executive order because there was no longer any type of allowance for new cases, new DACA applications. So I expect a bit of a shift now that they're available. And we'll just have to see how long they will be available for.
What do you tell some of your clients who fall under this program when they have questions for you? I'm sure a lot of them don't like feeling like they're in limbo. What do you tell them to either calm them or to tell them, let's just see how this plays out in the courts?
So, you know, what we were advising clients prior to the decision was renew now in anticipation that we weren't going to get the decision we did get. Chief Justice John Roberts was the swing vote, and we were anticipating a negative decision. So we were renewing even early to grandfather them in at that time and extend their ability to work, ability to get benefits, and have some type of status here in the United States. What I tell them now is, you know, the same. We don't know how long this is going to be good for. I imagine with the Department of Homeland Security statement they made yesterday and President Trump's tweet, I imagine they're going to come after the program again. So we need to act fast and eventually address the overall issue of unlawful status.
I was going to ask you, when you tell your clients to renew, what exactly does that mean?
So generally you have to wait within 150 days. You have to be within 150 days of your DACA status expiring to apply for a renewal of your DACA status. We were filing a year out, 365 days out, because we wanted to renew for two more years. It was a benefit to get the extra year, even though you're doing it early. And I think that's still sound advice.
What would a negative decision by the Supreme Court would have done? Would it mean that a lot of these DACA dreamers would have been facing possible deportation at some time? Or do you think there would have been an appeal coming that would have extended out and give them a little bit more breathing room?
No appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, right? So they would have been subject to deportation. When an individual loses their DACA status, they revert back to the status they had prior to DACA, and that's unlawful. So they're subject to deportation. Now, whether there have been a lawsuit once they attempted to execute deportations because of the reliance by DACA recipients by coming out the woodwork, giving them, the government, their information based upon this promise and reliance, that may have come, and that was kind of talked about in this Supreme Court's decision. That reliance by the DACA recipient really required the administration to adhere to comment process and requirements under the ACA.
Now, a lot of the DACA students, the dreamers, do feel, of course, that, you know, this isn't over with, that the Trump administration may at some point possibly renew their challenge to this. What are you telling your clients today? Be happy for today and let's worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow, what are you telling them?
So I say it's easier and it's better always to be proactive rather than reactive for many reasons. We can control the situation. We can control a lot more than when a government comes after them to deport and then we're reactive and behind the ball. So what we do is what I tell them is that we will address the whole situation, not just DACA. Is there any other relief? And we've been successful in that. There's been individuals that I've consulted with that have been told they're eligible only for DACA and actually been U.S. citizens by right, by birth. So you have to attack the whole legal situation of immigration status and to be proactive rather than reactive.
Well, Alfredo Estrada is a local attorney here in Northwest Indiana. He handles a tremendous amount of cases, but especially those dealing with DACA and immigration issues. Alfredo, thank you so much for joining us here today on Off Mic.
Thanks, Michael. Be good. We'll talk to you.
Thank you. And we'll be back with more Off Mic on a discussion about police reform.
During these trying times, we've been restricting the amount of guests we have in the Lakeshore studios. However, recently we've been lucky enough with the proper precautions to have Chef Nick back in the studio. Chef Nick got a chance to talk on the phone to touch base with a few fooderies and alcohol establishments and how they are dealing with COVID. This Friday at 3 o'clock, check out a special edition of Let's Eat with Chef Nick right here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Indiana Democrats now have a candidate for Attorney General. Question is, which Republican will he face in November? I'm Matt Pelzer. Next time on All In, we'll catch up on the week's biggest headlines, like the governor's promise that despite the budget shortfall, there will be no cuts to K-12 education. And a new novel set in Indiana addresses a lot of the current issues being grappled with around race and sexuality. We'll talk to the book's author, a Central Indiana native. Join us. Join us every day at noon here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Police reform continues to dominate the headlines. More protests are happening around the country. And right here in Northwest Indiana, at this hour, there's a protest happening in Merivale, all stemming from years of abuse against African Americans at the hands of police officers. The recent death of George Floyd in Minneapolis sparked the latest outcry. Then the death of another man in Atlanta keeps the story on the front pages. There have been calls to defund or to get rid of police forces entirely. Those ideas are also being talked about, including in Gary, Indiana, a city that is majority African-American and with a majority African-American police force. Recently, I had a chance to speak with three people on the matter. One is a former Gary police officer and now attorney James Dillon. We start off with him with his conversation. I asked Attorney Dillon about his time with the Gary Police Department.
I was hired in January of 2008, went to the Hope Police Academy. That was when Mayor Clay was mayor. We had some financial issues, they laid us off, and then I became a police officer at Valparaiso University.
And is that where you got your law degree?
That is where I got my law degree, absolutely.
Wow. When did you get an interest in law?
So I already had an interest in law. I had already taken the LSAT when I became a police officer, and I just didn't know where I was going to go. I thought I would go over to John Marshall because they have a lot of part-time programs. And it was kind of a silver lining in a dark cloud. I got laid off from Gary. I went to the academy with some folks from VU. They said, hey, we have an opening. You should apply. I applied, and I got it. And it got me a good discount on law school. So,
you know, there's a lot of calls for police reform in light of the George Floyd murder. And Gary is a predominantly African-American city. It has a predominantly African-American police force. So you might think, well, is reform even coming to them? And some people say, yeah, it still needs to. You have a unique perspective of that you're both a police officer and an attorney now dealing. And were you a one-time Gary resident?
Oh, I still live in Gary, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So, and you grew up in Gary?
Yes, I did.
Well, what high school did you go to?
Emerson School for the Visual and Performing Arts.
So tell me, what was it like growing up in Gary? Did you see a lot of black officers?
So I saw a lot of black officers growing up in Gary. My brother was a police officer before me, so he became a Gary police officer just after I graduated high school. I had other people that we knew from our church and just the community that were officers with the Gary Police Department. So I've always known a lot of black officers in the city of Gary, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to work there, and I saw it as a career path for me because I knew so many people there.
Did you also see white officers too?
Yeah, so at the time I started, it was probably 60-40 white to black. Mm-hmm. So even though it was a predominantly black city, it was probably mostly a majority white police department at that time. I think that under Mayor Clay, they began the policy of attempting to hire more Gary residents specifically. That had not been the policy under the previous two mayors. So there was a lot of white officers when I started. And they, you know, good officers, but you know, there were a lot of officers that were not from the community when I started.
And back then when they were saying they were trying to hire more, get more diversity and more people from Gary to serve as police officers, do you know what the catalyst was for that? What was the argument for that?
As I recall, it was the catalyst was when Mayor Clay came in, he recognized the system at the time for hiring police officers was that the Police Merit Board or Civil Service Commission held tests, interviewed people, and they ranked the list. And then based off the list that the Police Merit Board ranked, officers were hired off that list in the order that they were ranked. And there were a lot of complaints about that system that Gary residents some African-American candidates who have been successful officers other places and even eventually got on the Gary Police Department were ranked lower. So, if the list was 200 people and all we were going to have off the list, which normally lasted 2 years, mm-hmm. was 50 hires, chances are that top 50 were predominantly from outside the city. And Mayor Clay didn't like that, and so he wanted to change it. There was some pushback on it. I was in the first class. There was 10 officers that were hired where they changed the process. It was the list that was certified by the Civil Service Commission, but Mayor Clay said the chief can choose whoever he wants off this list because everybody on this list is eligible. And it was an eligibility list, so everybody was eligible. And the chief chose 10 names to send to the academy, and we went to the academy in 2008. I will say before we got on the department and while we were going through the process, there was a lot of animosity from officers against us. And the thought was that we would be less qualified because we weren't at the top of the list and things like that because they were ranked. The rankings in my mind were very subjective and not objective. But I will say once we got on the department all of that went away. And we were fully accepted. It was all good. And I understood what the FOP and what the officers were trying to do. There was a system that had been in place for a long time, and they felt it was working. So that they were just kind of, fighting for the system that they felt had worked, and it wasn't personal. And like I said, when we got on the department, everything was okay.
Growing up, did you ever get a sense that, and a lot of maybe teenagers might feel this, but growing up, did you feel a sense that cops sometimes would pick on teenagers, black teenagers, and maybe you would get more, maybe picked upon by white cops against black kids in Gary?
So I would say no, not in Gary. Growing up, I grew up in Gary, and growing up, when I started driving, I got my fair share of tickets, but most of the tickets I got were from black cops. So I did get my fair share of tickets when I was in high school for speeding. The only times we saw issues were, and I felt it was just a little heavy at the time. When I was in high school, of course, similar to I'm sure it is now, there's really nowhere to go in Gary for high school kids. So after football games, after basketball games, we come out to Hobart or we come out to Maryville. And I think there was a certain time, maybe 10 o'clock, where the police would come into Stardust Bowling Alley or come into Denny's. And I thought sometimes they were a little indiscriminate. They would absolutely, all of us, whoever it was that did not look like they lived in the town, which at the time, Hobart and Maryville were predominantly white, you got to go. You got to leave the bowling alley, you got to go. I did feel that was a little bit heavy-handed. We always felt like we were being chased out.
And you describe yourself as a civil rights attorney?
Yeah, so I do, my practice includes civil rights, criminal defense, and some personal injury. I'm also the legal redress chair for the Indiana State Conference of the NAACP.
Now, the discussion that that's happening nationally is about police reform and in police districts everywhere. Do you feel, as a Gary resident, as a former Gary cop, and now as a civil rights attorney, that discussion also needs to happen in Gary, despite having majority black population, black leadership, and perhaps black majority police department? Is that discussion, are there still problems with the black community, with officers, whether they be black or white, in Gary?
Yeah. So I believe there are absolutely still problems that need to be addressed on a national level and including in Gary. And that's when you get into the concept of systematic racism. It's not that any particular police officer that I personally know is targeting somebody who's black or targeting something like that. But when you have outdated policies like, you know, that were held over from the 90s war on drugs, and, you know, police officers police different in poverty. I know that because I was a Gary police officer, and then I went out to Valpo University. And police officers police different in poverty. And it some of it is how we're trained, but some of it is also how funding comes. You know, there's funding available, there's grants available for police officers to saturate certain areas and to do certain things. And that leads to over-policing. So when you have over-policing, of course you're going to have more arrests and you're going to have more things like that.
And that was Northwest Indiana Attorney James Dillon, a former Gary police officer who is now a civil rights attorney in Northwest Indiana. Another Northwest Indiana resident I had a chance to speak with is Latricia Wilson, who grew up in Gary and says she's had good experiences working with cops in her city. Wilson, who is African-American, also has other ideas about police reform.
Latricia Sharice Wilson.
What has been your interaction like, your experience like, with the Gary Police Department?
I haven't had any interactions except for one time I had locked myself out of my apartment when I first moved in. And so the Gary Police, they basically escorted me to the police department while I tried to figure out how to contact my landlord because it was raining and it was at night. And I remember, like, I had just moved in, and so I guess I didn't have all the keys to everything. So, I mean, it's really limited in terms of personal, like, one-on-one experience, if that makes sense. From what I've noticed, it's a predominantly black police force there. I can't even count on my hand how many, like, white officers I've seen since I've lived out there. And it makes me feel more comfortable, I would say, the presence of it being predominantly black, because it's a predominantly, like, African-American community in Gary. So, yeah.
Tell me, why do you feel more comfortable when you're driving through the city? Is it one less thing to worry about that you may get pulled over simply because you're black?
I think I feel a sense of comfort just because I feel like the police who are policing the area on a daily basis, they have some things in common with me. We share the same race. We may even share similar backgrounds. That may or may not be the case, but having someone, or mostly individuals of your same race, policing your community, to me, it gives me a better sense of comfort versus maybe for just being honest, a white cop who may or may not, it's by a long shot, ever lived in Gary. Or maybe they don't even live anywhere close to Gary, or not familiar with the people as much. Or, you know, that sort of thing. May not be in tune with my culture or anything of that nature. So I guess get a better sense of familiarity, if that makes sense, with a black cop versus a white cop, I guess.
What do you do for a living?
I'm a teacher, English teacher. No, in Chicago, Illinois, yes.
You know, when you're driving through other, say, whiter areas, have you had interaction with police there?
I have had limited interaction. Same thing. The interactions that I have had as a black woman, it was positive. Like, the interaction where I've had to actually call the police, like, again, I locked myself out of my car one time. I don't know how I did that. I was trying to, it was a blizzard, and I was trying to clear the snow off of my car. And it was when the polar vortex through that whole Jussie Smollett thing was going on. And the door closed on me. I jumped out the car, and then I guess I forgot I had it, forgot to, you know, that the fact that I didn't unlock everything. And so I was locked out, and then I had to go to a random neighbor's house, a white guy that I, you know, didn't know me, but he did call the police for me, and the guy came, didn't charge me anything. The police came and basically jimmied my lock so I can get in my car, because I would have froze to death outside. My keys, my everything was inside my car. And so as far as what I've seen in terms of interactions with other black people, like traffic stops, I have seen a lot of traffic stops of young, like, black men. But I guess in all fairness, I have also seen kind of an equal, if that makes sense, equal number of traffic stops riding through Lake Station of also white men and white women. So in terms of, like, feeling like I may be racially profiled as a black woman, it seems like it's less of a chance that I may be racially profiled.
What do you think about all the conversations that are happening around the country, you know, talking about police reform, police defunding, because of the interactions between police departments and black people?
All right, so I'm going to tell you what I think on in terms of being for or against defunding. I am against defunding the police department or otherwise what's happening in Minneapolis, this dismantling the police altogether. I'm going to say that because personally, based upon having lived in predominantly black neighborhoods and lower income neighborhoods for a nice majority of my life. I used to live in Memphis again, like, for many, many years. So having lived in these areas, the police do need to be called because, unfortunately, there's, you know, a higher number of shootings taking place. There's a lot of drug dealing in certain areas due to socioeconomic reasons, but there is more violent crime in my own community. So I just can't imagine, and I'm just going to speak on some of the lower income black community. I cannot imagine removing police completely and with let's talk about Chicago, 80-something people shot over the last weekend. So I just can't imagine dismantling a police department if a community is prone to violence and there's a lot of violence and random shootings going on. Like, who are we going to call? So, I mean, I disagree with defunding the police department. We need the police. There's children that get raped, molested. There's all types of drug dealing going on in different areas, whether it's my community, a white community, wherever it may be. There's crime occurring, and me as a regular citizen, I can't police that. And I wouldn't want to entrust just anybody in my neighborhood. I feel that we do need, like, trained police to police our areas, or there'll be anarchy. We'll have a purge situation in America if we defund, which is happening right now. People committing. My mom, for instance, had someone in Atlanta come in on her in her very home. She lives in Atlanta, and it took the police 40 minutes to get there because they're short-staffed police right now from so many police quitting in Atlanta. So, so yeah, it was really crazy. So I just don't agree with that. I just feel like opportunists would take advantage of that as a means to commit even more heinous crimes, and you will see anarchy in our country.
At least have the dialogue, talk about reform, how to make things better.
All right. So, yeah, I don't agree with defunding. What I do feel like what needs to happen with reform, I feel like Congress is doing a good job right now. It looks like they're trying to make steps to ban certain types of tactics that's used to restrain individuals. And they want to make sure that people that are, like, stopped or for nonviolent offenses that are not being violent, they want to make sure that they're not being, if that makes sense, they're not being handled too hostile, and police are not killing people who are otherwise, like, nonviolent committing nonviolent offenses. That these people actually make it to jail. We want to make sure they make it to jail if they deserve to go to jail and to their court day, and that we're not like executing police officers or not executing people on the scene over like a possible fake $20 bill. So I do agree with police reform, police doing psychological testing and figuring out ways to create different policies where there's a clear boundary of what police should do or should not do in specific situations. I feel that more officers should be charged when we do see like viral videos where they clearly cross the line. Not just charged, but an example should be made. They should serve some sort of prison sentence, because in America, no citizen, for the most part, can openly commit, could kill someone on camera and get away with it. So I feel that police should not be able to get away with on the same token, if that makes sense.
Yeah, they're on a higher standard.
Yes.
And they should be held to that.
They should be held to a higher standard. They, you know, have an oath to protect and serve. We should, as people, should make a personal oath to protect and serve each other, but oftentimes we as people fail to do so. And so that's where we rely on the police to like have that higher standard, or meet that higher standard, if that makes sense, at all times.
Latrice Wilson says she believes there needs to be more cooperation between the police and the African American community.
We accept it if it's a black person and we move on. But if it's a white officer involved, all hell, like we might know that we're actually going to lose. We might know that we're going to lose this battle, that white cop probably will get off. But we will fight like hell to the end if it's a white person, whether it's a police or non-police. Black people will fight to the end for justice. If it's another black person killing another black person, we tend to accept it more. Does that make sense? And I don't want to be a part of that anymore. If it's somebody in my family, and I don't care who it is, and that my family member was murdered, I'm not going to be the person that just accepts it and say, oh, well, I can't do anything about it. I want to fight. I want to try to see who the detective is. I want to stay on top of things and try to, you know, whatever I can do to try to seek justice, right? And not just wait until it's racially motivated. Now I'm raising hell about it. There's something wrong with that. Murder is murder. If you feel your family member has been murdered, raise hell regardless of who murdered them. That's all I'm saying. And I think there's a double standard in that approach.
And that was Gary native Latricia Wilson from Gary. When we come back, we end the show with a conversation with Gary, Indiana Mayor Jerome Prince.
During these trying times, we've been restricting the amount of guests we have in the Lakeshore studios. However, recently we've been lucky enough with the proper precautions to have Chef Nick back in the studio. Chef Nick got a chance to talk on the phone to touch base with a few fooderies and alcohol establishments and how they are dealing with COVID. This Friday at 3 o'clock, check out a special edition of Let's Eat with Chef Nick right here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Indiana Democrats now have a candidate for Attorney General. Question is, which Republican will he face in November? I'm Matt Pelzer. Next time on All In, we'll catch up on the week's biggest headlines, like the governor's promise that despite the budget shortfall, there will be no cuts to K-12 education. And a new novel set in Indiana addresses a lot of the current issues being grappled with around race and sexuality. We'll talk to the book's author, a Central Indiana native. Join us. Join us every day at noon here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente, Northwest Indiana Bureau Reporter for WBEZ. Our conversation about police reform continues with a conversation with Gary, Indiana Mayor Jerome Prince. Mayor Prince recently announced the creation of a commission to address the Gary Police Department's use of force policy. Here's that conversation.
What I announced is that we would establish a commission to look into potential police reforms, to be very specific. And ultimately, what we hope to come out of that are a set of recommendations that are based on facts and certainly based on experiences that have taken place and, you know, here locally and just to be completely frank with you, across the country relative to policing and police reforms.
All right. And is that something that's going to be established relatively soon, or does that have to go through city council or anything like that?
Great question. So I've established the commission, or will be establishing it tomorrow by way of executive order. So that should, you know, pretty much answer that question. But in terms of a time frame, I expect to have the commission formed in at least or within the next 30 days. And shortly thereafter, and ideally 30 days thereafter, I'd expect some recommendations to come out of that commission.
All right. Let me ask you something, Mayor. Since you, before you became mayor of Gary, and let's say even a little bit after, what were there any issues that you became aware of or wanted to address once you became mayor? Problems within the Gary Police Department?
So, you know, I would say nothing specific other than the fact that, you know, there were a number of issues that were expressed to me by officers and just persons who were affiliated with the station or with the police department. And those issues were related to the lack of proper equipment and resources in order for them to actually perform their job. And so that within itself was, you know, a primary concern. Outside of that, you know, I'm always of the impression that there's always room for improvement. And so, you know, I guess you could say that one of my goals was to try to ensure that we have the most adequately functioning department and that we address issues that were raised prior to this administration, you know, by the public in general.
All right. You know, one of the stories I'm working on is taking a look at issues throughout Northwest Indiana, but primarily like in places like in Gary, where you have a high minority population and a number of African-American police officers and those in leadership. One might think because of that, maybe there isn't as the same problems with the community may have with police departments as in other areas. Is that true, or do you think there still can be issues with communication or just how the public interacts with the police department, irregardless of race?
So, yeah, and I'm glad you spelled it out, you know, in the last part of your question. That's what it sounded like, Michael, that we were talking about potential racism. And so, you know, you and I both know that Gary's predominantly black community with a predominantly black police force, right? And so, but I think you and I also both know that racism takes many forms. It's in many ways just part of the fabric of our society and our institutions and elsewhere. And we certainly can't deny that it exists. Under that premise, you know, I certainly don't have or haven't heard or been made aware of any issues of racism that are present relative to the relationship between our constituents and the police department. I'm not aware of any that exist internally, but just based on the parameters that I started with when I began to answer this question, it's certainly something that we won't be opposed to looking at. And certainly if there are instances where it exists, we will be definitely looking for opportunities to root it out.
So Gary definitely isn't, like the Gary Police Department isn't insulated from this overall conversation that police departments and communities are having nationwide about reform.
Well, no, absolutely not insulated in, from the conversations about reform. However, I will point out that every community is different and every instance is different. So nationally, you know, the attention is definitely on the issue of racism as it relates to the execution of police powers, right? I don't think that, or at least certainly I haven't heard that that's the issue necessarily here. You know, and so, but again, we won't dismiss that it exists because of what we understand about racism fundamentally.
Mayor, how do you want, or how do you see your police force interacting with your citizens?
Well, I think we began with the steps that I took, you know, here recently, or that we will take tomorrow, and that's establishing a commission, which will be responsible for reviewing the existing policies within the city, as well as reviewing policies across the country. From there, I anticipate to get a series of recommendations, and in addition to that, recommendations relative to the advisory council or commission or whatever thing you want to call it. Simply what I'm suggesting is that I believe there is an opportunity to have a particular entity, right, sanctioned by the city of Gary as well as the police department, that engages with police with the Gary Police Department relative to exploring the policies that exist, with an eye towards changing policies in areas that are necessary. So in short, I view it as a collaborative effort. But generically speaking, you know, in a perfect scenario, I would envision that our police department would be viewed as allies and as friends of the communities versus being viewed as enforcers. I think that certainly with that premise in mind, it doesn't help to foster better relations. In some instances, you know, if that is the perception, it exacerbates, you know, the perception of what people have. And we want to dispel those myths. We want to get our police department and our officers, rather, into the streets, communicating with our residents and letting them know that they're on our side and they're here to protect and service as their statutory requirement has them to do.
But the reason behind establishing a police reform commission is to address concerns levied by your constituents in Gary over the past week or so in trying to move the conversation further.
Well, that's part of it. And then the other part is just a general responsible approach at looking at our present policies and looking where there may be opportunities to either redirect funding or enhance or change or eliminate policies that exist, in an effort to make sure that we're providing the very best service to our constituents. And so, yeah, the commission certainly is born out of the spirit that exists here locally and across the country, but it's not simply a reactionary effort because of just that. We realize, largely because of things that we've either heard or witnessed or experienced throughout the years, certainly it's driven by things that happen across the country. And I think it would be extremely naive for anyone, including me, to think that, you know, Gary is somehow insulated and not impacted by, you know, some of the things that happen in other places. And so, again, the commission is an effort for us to be responsible and take a good look at what we're doing, our practices, and the areas where we can make enhancements or changes, we certainly will.
Okay, Mayor, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Mr. Puente, the pleasure is always mine as usual, and I look forward to getting back into the studio here soon and having a one-on-one with you. Thank you.
No problem. Thank you.
And that was Gary, Indiana Mayor Jerome Prince talking about police reform. And that's all the time we have for today's show. I'd like to thank all the guests, and I'd like to thank my show's producer, Jose Rodriguez, D. Dotson, and Tom Maloney. You can hear the show again as a podcast by going to lakeshorepublicradio.org. I'm Michael Puente. You can hear me the rest of the week on WBEZ in Chicago. Have a nice weekend and stay safe.